You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up, we have American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am welcoming you to American Standoff. We're a fairly new KBOO show here in Portland that examines the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And I always open with referencing the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol in D.C. And in fact, our very first show for American Standoff premiered on a 1 year later to the date, January 6, 2022. And as you may recall, you know, thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and they later stormed the Capitol and to contest Biden's election. And the big lie is still quite a potent force politically in this country today. And we're keeping an eye on that, and we will have actually the next episode we're doing will be focusing particularly on the big lie itself and its role. And you know, we've seen these insurrectionists in our own streets. You know, we've seen the Proud Boys. I covered a Proud Boy gathering back in 2018, right on the waterfront in Portland, and I interviewed some of them as well. And we've seen these things happen. Of course, December 21st, 2020, just a few weeks before the U.S. Capitol was stormed, our own Capitol here in Oregon, in Salem, was also breached by armed insurrectionists who were defying COVID restrictions. And of course, they were admitted to the building by former state rep Mike Nierman, who we will actually discuss more in this episode today. So today on American Standoff, we'll be discussing the breakaway movement in Eastern Oregon and Northern California counties, where conservative residents in these counties wish to leave their respective blue states and join Idaho, right? And so it's sometimes called the Greater Idaho Movement. It's a slogan, not the actual suggested name of the new state. You know, of course, they don't plan to move anywhere physically. They just want to move the border, right, and take all this land and create this mega state, which I think would be one of the largest states in the country. With this show, American Standoff, my goal is to examine connections between seemingly disparate events and their origins in white supremacy, which I see as part of as a journalist and an author. The DNA of colonialism, particularly as a Native woman, where I see that coming from, and the ongoing occupation of our homelands in this land that is called the United States now. And once again, my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host. And this is a call-in show, So please do call in. The number here in the studio is 503-231-8187. So this movement of Greater Oregon is really sort of the brainchild of an organization called Move Oregon's Borders, and which aims to, as I mentioned, to adjust the state borders to form a Greater Idaho. In total, 22 Eastern Oregon counties and several Northern California counties do have expressed a wish to become a part of Idaho. The movement's leaders say that Idaho, with the Republican majority, would be a better fit for them, for conservative residents in Eastern Oregon and Northern California. So in Oregon, actually recently, the majority of residents in two counties voted in favor of this border change. They were Jefferson County, which 51.02% of voters, about 5,655 residents, voted in support of the measure. And in Union County, 52.42% of voters, about 7,401 residents, supported it. So, you know, we my book Standoff, that I often reference in the show, which takes a really deep dive at the DNA of colonialism in this country and contrasts it to by looking at the Ammon Bundy's takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon in 2016, and contrast it to Standing Rock, the Lakota-led fight for water and for more sane policy towards fossil fuel dependency by being led by our own people. Does this mean that Ammon Bundy and his fringe militia groups that conducted an armed standoff in Malheur in 2016 are still gaining traction? We like to think that was in the past, that was 6 years ago, but Bundy was running for governor. He has since given up on his run for governor of Idaho. His brother Ryan Bundy had previously run for governor of Nevada. I think he only got like 2% of the vote. And Bundy was also recently arrested for trespassing at a hospital and found guilty on two of three charges, including obstructing law enforcement officers and trespassing. So we'll open the show actually with a short explainer about the Greater Idaho movement.
Refuge from blue states. They think Oregon is dominated by urban liberal folks, and they've decided they'd rather join with Idaho, a conservative and rural state they see as being more in line with their values.
In rural Oregon, you have people who consider themselves neighbors, and they live hundreds of miles apart. And in urban centers, your neighbor is the door down the hall. People ride scooters in their suits to get to work. People in rural counties, they have to put their boots on, get in the truck, and drive tens of miles just to get to the end of their lane or their property.
So what specifically do they not like? Well, it's a lack of representation for rural areas in the state legislature. It's the decision by the state of Oregon to decriminalize drugs last year, and it's also the tax rate. They say they want out.
We can look at what they're trying to do right now in session. They're trying to outlaw diesel. They're trying to put massive regulations on fuel, and a lot of this is this land is for ranching and farming, and so that makes it nearly impossible for anybody out here to make a livelihood.
It might be a nice idea, but it's a little bit tricky. First of all, you would have to have both the state legislatures of Idaho and Oregon pass laws changing the borders. Then the U.S. Congress would have to give its stamp of approval. That's a little bit of a long shot. Now, the folks who currently want to break away from Oregon say the roadblocks do not deter them.
We didn't want to leave Oregon. Oregon kind of left us behind. The rural counties in eastern and southern Oregon are very much left out of the conversation that happens in our state capital. We make up about 20% of the state's population, and we live on 3/4 of the land. There's not much reason why the urban populist centers need to listen to us. They outvote us every time, and we just find that it's a better place to get our voices heard in Idaho.
So there you heard sort of a very short explainer about the Greater Idaho movement that we are going to be discussing today here on the show on American Standoff. And once again, this is a live talk radio show, so please do call in to the studio if you want to be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187, and my name is Jacqueline Huber, and I'm your host. Okay. So the I also like to start these shows out by introducing myself in my own language or tradition. In Navajo, we say Yak'e, and She'e Jacqueline Huber, and She'e. My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and you know, I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation, which is one of the largest Native nation in this country. It has land base the size of Ireland, 400,000 enrolled citizens, and I am Yankton Sioux as well through my father. My mother is Navajo, and my father is Yankton Dakota, Ihaktawan Dakota. And I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, are the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kalamet, Clackamas, and Cowlitz bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. I have to say, this is not my homeland either. My family are from the Navajo Nation and from the Dakotas. And so, so with the show, as I mentioned before, the thesis or focus of American Standoff is what happened on January 6th last year, and what we all saw when the U.S. Capitol was stormed, and what have we learned, right? And so today we're discussing Greater Oregon and whether it is gaining traction. Please call in to be a part of this conversation. Once again, the number is 503-231-8187. The slight description of this movement, this breakaway movement of Greater Idaho, being a peaceful revolution, particularly that language is used by Move Oregon Borders leader Mike McArthur, the Carter of Lapine, Oregon. We have seen this has not always been the case. As we saw when Mike Nierman, former Oregon state rep, allowed armed protesters into the building, Capitol building at Salem in December 2020. Of course, he was later expelled from the state legislature for this. Let's actually play some audio kind of reviewing that history of our own armed insurrection at Salem. I can replay the audio about the far-right violence and GOP complicity in allowing armed protesters into the Capitol building of Salem.
Democrats like Portland Representative Barbara Smith Warner say with that attitude, it'll be hard to get back to business as usual.
You need to demonstrate to me that you believe in small d democracy. Actions like walking out to stop the process and signing letters asking that entire state's vote tallies get thrown out because you disagree with them. It's not only Mike Nierman letting armed protesters into the building, it's that whole idea of, if I don't agree with the results, I'll overturn them. That demonstrates a lack of belief in the system.
Was a line crossed, though, in December?
The idea that one of my colleagues opened the door and let them in, not just figuratively, literally. What we saw in DC made us realize, holy crap, that was an act of calculated aggression against his colleagues, against everybody in that building. And how do you work with that?
Okay, so the first part of that audio got cut off, and it kind of vividly described and put you in the moment of the actual violent entry into the Capitol. And so you only heard the last quarter of the audio. But I just really wanted to put you back in the mind, sort of the feelings of what it was like to have, in the midst of a pandemic, to have our Capitol building in Salem be breached by armed folks refusing to comply with health measures meant to protect all of us, and to be assisted by a member of a GOP legislator at the Capitol. And so you just heard the last little bit where they were interviewing one of another legislator about her feelings about what that felt like and what would follow up. So I just wanted to say what kind of, I really wanted to kind of convey there. And so and this division at the state capitol has not stopped. Last week, Oregon Republican Party Chair Dallas Hurd resigned, claiming his spirit was broken by the wickedness in his party and the use of communist psychological warfare tactics against him. So let's play the audio of Dallas Hurd quitting his position.
Communist psychological warfare tactics, end quote, are being used daily. Tonight, State Senator Dallas Hurd is stepping down as chair of the Oregon Republican Party. He says it's because of, quote, evil and wickedness within the party. Those are his words. So Hurd wrote a letter resigning as of this Friday. He says, quote, communist psychological warfare tactics, end quote, are being used daily in the GOP, and that his physical and spiritual health can no longer survive. He points to a laundry list here, really, slander, gossip, conspiracies, sabotage, lies, and hatred. Wow. Okay. However, he says he will still hang on to his seat in the legislature. For context here, Hurd is a far-right Republican. He's protested mask mandates and COVID restrictions, and he encouraged those who broke into the Oregon Capitol in December 2020 in the U.S. Capitol a month later. He became chair of the state GOP last year after the former chair quit.
Yeah. So that was sort of a news brief about former GOP Republican chair Dallas Hurd, Oregon Republican representative, former representative. He still is a state senator, but although he has said that he does not plan to run again, once again citing that his spirit had been broken over the wickedness and communist psychological warfare tactics within his party. He's referring to there that he was asked to leave the legislature because he refused to put a mask on. And so these sort of ideas of really making the issue of COVID mandates as being these sort of really overarching authoritarian measures against their freedom is a major talking point. And I know that we have covered also the trucker convoy, which kind of petered out here in the U.S., but we covered it in Canada and the impact that had. And you may also remember that in 2019, 11 Oregon Republican lawmakers ran off to Idaho to prevent a quorum to be achieved on a vote for a climate change bill. They actually gloated about it on Fox News. Idaho has long been, as you can see, sort of this refuge for this divide, this divide in our state, right? We talk, this show often talks about the standoff, you know, nationally, but in the state itself, this divide has been very keenly felt and has impacted our daily lives and of course the functioning of our government. And also, as I mentioned earlier, in Idaho, Ammon Bundy, who took over and occupied with an armed militia the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon, he announced 8 months ago that he was running for Idaho governor, and I'd like to play a little clip of his announcement.
It is officially official. Ammon Bundy is running for governor of Idaho as a Republican. He filed with the Secretary of State's office back in May, but made his official announcement this afternoon in front of hundreds of people at Kleiner Park in Meridian.
Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come. And so I'm announcing now that I will be running as governor for the great state of Idaho.
Earlier this month, Tom Luna, the chairman of the Idaho GOP party, released a statement saying Bundy is, quote, not suited to call himself an Idaho Republican, let alone run for governor in our great state. Bundy is currently banned from the Idaho State House, at least for a few more months, after he was arrested twice during the special session back in August on charges of trespassing and resisting and obstructing officers. Bundy joins current Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan, as well as several other candidates who have already announced their plans to run for the position.
So that was some coverage in Idaho of Ammon Bundy's announcement that he was running for governor of Idaho. And he was actually banned from the state legislature because he had refused to wear a mask as well. And of course, the NC mentions that Idaho Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan is also running. And yet she recently, even though the GOP in Idaho claims that Ammon doesn't represent them, she certainly does, right? She's an elected official from their party. But she recently came under fire when she preemptively ended an interview just the other day after being questioned about her ties to white nationalists. This after she spoke at a conference organized by prominent white nationalist and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes. You may recall we discussed Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, also Republicans, who also spoke at the America First Political Action Conference at the end of February, and which was put together by a white nationalist Groyper leader, Nick Fuentes. And initially, the GOP minority leader, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said, "There's no place in our party for any of this. The party should not be associated anytime, any place with somebody who is anti-Semitic. This is unacceptable." Yet a few weeks later, what was unacceptable was given a pass by the GOP leader. So McCarthy, he went further and told reporters that the duo, Green and Gosar, could possibly get their committee assignments back once they take the House in the fall, if they do take the House in the fall. So let's listen to Idaho Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan's response to a reporter's repeated questions about her ties to Nick Fuentes.
Did you not look into it before you decided to say okay, like to find out? I mean, his name is on it.
Well, you know what, Nick Fuentes, I don't know him. I've never met him. I don't know, everything that he says or doesn't say does not reflect on who I am or who the thousands of others that are participating in this movement.
You didn't bother to look up his name or anything?
I didn't say that.
You did look him up?
You didn't, that's not the question that you asked me.
Did you look up who Nick Fuentes was and what he's talked about? Like things he has said?
I have since.
Since last week, not before?
Yes.
Okay, I guess the question is, because if you've said, well, I'm only
again,
here
it's not fair. I mean, the mainstream media, you do this to conservatives all the time, but you don't do it to yourself. That anytime there's any kind of affiliation with anybody at any time on any stage, that we're all guilty by association, and it's not appropriate.
But the association is not a good one. To be associated with people who are anti-Semitic.
Stop. Yes. Excuse me.
Yes.
You asked me why I was there, why I wanted to participate and speak to these young conservatives. That's what we're talking about right now.
Okay. Vincent James is also there, correct? Do you know who Vincent James is?
I've heard of him.
You've had your picture taken with him?
I did have my picture taken with him.
Okay. Do you know what he stands for and things that he has said?
No, I don't know all the things that he or anybody else. And again, I'm just going to keep repeating the same thing, that this guilt by association that the media tries to do with conservatives and conservatives only, we're all guilty by association. If you want to know why I went there and what my message was, go watch my video.
I did watch your video, and if you had known,
that's what it was all about.
If you had known who Nick Fuentes is, would you have said yes?
Well, again, this movement is so much bigger than one individual. Who cares what Nick Fuentes has to say? Who cares? There's thousands and thousands of young conservatives all across the country that are very concerned and about what's happening to our country. We are fighting for the soul of our nation. With these wide open borders, it's only a matter of time that America, we lose who we are as a free country. And so, and I'm not gonna run away. I'm not gonna hide from being willing and wanting to go talk to young conservatives about these issues.
If you say nobody cares what Nick Fuentes says, but people care that you're associated with them or that you share a stage with something.
Again,
like that.
You're trying to do this guilt by association over and over and over again, and it needs to stop. Because if you want to know who I am and why I went there, I told you that. And you know, don't assassinate me or my character over something that any individual that I may ever have met in my life. If there are things that are said or that they believe in, then that's that person, it's not me.
But that's not the first time. My point of bringing up Vincent James.
There you go.
Right? I mean, that's not the first time you've been associated with this group.
Interview's over.
All right, thank you, I appreciate it.
So yeah, so there you were listening to Lieutenant Governor Lieutenant Governor of Idaho and her response to reporter Lieutenant Governor her response to reporters' questions about her ties to Nick Fuentes, and she understood who he was before she spoke at his conference, and you can hear that she's quite defensive and doesn't own up to the fact that it was pretty apparent that the people she's hanging out with are white nationalists. And that she's deflecting by saying she's trying to speak to younger Republicans and to thousands of younger Republicans, which is very concerning that there are thousands of young people who follow this incredibly repellent and divisive character named Nick Fuentes. So it's interesting how he will deny their support of these really quite vicious right, you know, these anti-Semitic and white supremacist leaders, but they at the same time they pursue the votes they get from those really heinous positions, political positions. She doesn't actually sound like much of an alternative to Ammon Bundy, does she? Ammon Bundy, who, as I mentioned earlier, was recently arrested and yesterday found guilty of trespassing at a hospital and interfering with law enforcement. While he was trespassing at the hospital unmasked, the hospital actually had to be shut down and people had to seek care elsewhere, which is pretty concerning if someone had, you know, a really serious medical issue that needed to be dealt with. He, as I mentioned earlier, he has suspended his run for governor of Idaho. I'd also like to encourage you all to call into the studio. This is a call-in show, American Standoff. If you want to be part of this conversation, we're discussing the greater Idaho and potential support that it's been getting and traction. The number in the studio is 503-231-8187, and my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm your host. In the midst of this, we kind of brought out a lot of other characters from Ammon Bundy, we're kind of governor of Idaho, all these guys. But let's take a deeper dive into greater Idaho right now and look more closely at the issue.
To the growing divide between rural and urban America. Tonight, an effort in rural Oregon is well underway to literally leave the state and become part of Idaho. More and more Oregon counties say that the urban centers do not represent the state that they want to be a part of. Arcana Whitworth reports.
Divisions in America continue to widen.
Today, Oregon's making a stand.
Fueled by the pandemic and a divisive election season, but perhaps none more than the disillusion between urban and rural, and no place is experiencing the urgency quite like Oregon. Political unrest has been growing in the state for decades.
The feelings have been there for almost 100 years.
Of the 36 counties in Oregon, 26 voted for Donald Trump in the last presidential election, President Joe Biden winning just 10. but that included the liberal city center of Portland. Biden ultimately won the state by 16 points. That similar scenario has played out for over 40 years. Some residents in rural areas say they feel overlooked.
For 20 years, we've tried to elect a better balance into the state legislature.
The last time a Republican won was Reagan. Last November, two rural Oregon counties voted in favor of ballot initiatives that could lead to being incorporated into Idaho. Last month, five more counties followed suit. Put together, these seven rural counties are larger than Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Delaware combined.
It's got a life of its own right now. I can watch it, I can feel it take off. This would be Oregon.
Mike McCarter, president of Citizens for Greater Idaho, believes redrawing the state line can become a reality, and he thinks it's time.
Oh, it's great right now. The momentum is incredible.
Members of the movement say their needs, concerns, contributions, and way of life are being ignored by state leaders.
You've got to realize that 78% of Oregon's population is in the Willamette Valley on 21% of the land.
They would use this part of the Deschutes River that has long been a symbolic dividing line as the actual border, and Idaho would gain enough land to make it the third largest state in the country.
Over the next few months, six eastern and southern Oregon counties have meetings set to discuss joining Idaho. Idaho Falls State Representative Barbara Ehart sees adding land, resources, and like-minded people to the second fastest growing state in the country as a positive.
Why not have a conversation when you're looking at dealing with people who absolutely have like-minded values, who appreciate those things, particularly maintaining our constitutional values, maintaining our First Amendment rights to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and to allow people to kind of live and be accountable for themselves.
Not everyone is on board, though. Clay Berenson, a Medford, Oregon city councilman, is against the plan despite a majority of his constituents supporting the proposal.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous. I think it's another byproduct of our failing two-party system. I think that, you know, people have become so polarized that they can't even accept anything if it comes from the other side of the aisle. And you know, rather than trying to find compromise and bipartisanship, they would just rather leave the state and go hang out with the state that is more friendly to their ideals.
What do you have to say to people that feel like you should just move to Idaho?
It goes all the way back to the difference between urban and rural. We're rural out here. Rural folks have that traditional value of family, faith, and freedom. We're tied to our land. Many of us out here are multiple generations on the same piece of property. We don't want to move to a new place. We're tied into our schools. We're tied into our families. So moving is not the option.
Both state legislatures and the U.S. Congress have to come to an agreement for the change to happen, a process even Idaho Governor Brad Little acknowledges is steep, telling ABC News that there's a lot that needs to happen before moving the border is within the realm of possibility. In this bitterly divided political climate,
stop supporting a fascist president.
Some hoping state pride will win out.
I would hope that, you know, people would maybe look at a different political perspective and maybe, you know, don't cling to their political parties and be a part of the solutions.
Five counties in Oregon.
Okay, so that was that deeper dive into the greater Idaho movement. We have a caller, Arthur.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, hi, Arthur. You're on American Standoff.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I got a couple of loose comments. Obviously, the lieutenant governor of Idaho is a fascist. Okay, that's my opinion. And here's this whole concept of people from Oregon wanting to go to Idaho. They should just sell their property. Hold on a second. They want the border to be redrawn to become part of Idaho, but you know, if they really feel that strongly with their ideology, if they really feel that strongly, they should just sell the property and then move to Idaho. And because the land is very important. I mean, land is more important than ideology. But if the idea, if ideology is that important, they should give up the land and sell it, and then move to Idaho, and then they can do, set up their own state ideology there. I don't, this whole moving the border thing sounds like a bunch of fascists trying to grab land from Oregon. I'll talk about it, but thanks.
Yes, thank you, Arthur. Thank you. Yeah, I have to say I totally agree. What was interesting to me was that he didn't want to be moved, right? He wants things to move around him, right? And these rural folks and their ownership of the land, and they're a minority of people in the state, but they occupy the majority of the land. When I covered the Malheur Wildlife refuge takeover, Harney County, the county that the Malheur Wildlife Refuge is in, is the size of New Jersey. It's a huge county, but it has a population, I think, of about 7,000 people. They're saying there that there's more cattle than people in Harney County. But we have to ask ourselves, you know, how did these people get the land, right? In my book, I do in my coverage of the Malheur Wildlife takeover by Ammon Bundy in 2016, I really focused on the perspective of the Burns Paiute people, right? What is now the Malheur Wildlife Refuge was originally their reservation. It was actually much larger, a 1.8 million acre reservation that was called the Malheur Indian Reservation, right? And they lost that after the Bannock Wars. They were dispossessed of their lands, and then they were force marched in January in the middle of like 2 feet of snow. Some of them had their legs shackled together. They were force marched up to Fort Simcoe on the Yakima Reservation in Washington State. And they were basically outlaws in their own homeland after that. So how did these folks get the land? And a lot of them talk about all the generations they've been here. I think that the one guy was talking about that it's been 200 years this has been going on. And, you know, Oregon isn't this hasn't been going on for 200 years in Oregon. It's been much more recent than that, the removal of Indian people. And I wanted to look at this really different view that Indian people have. I am working on an article right now about the land back issue and, the land acknowledgement issue. And I've mentioned this before, where the city of Gladstone here in the Portland area is refusing, some of the city council members are refusing to even vote on having a land acknowledgement kind of issued for the city. And because they fear, right, this is what they've said in their council meetings, and you can watch them on YouTube, they fear that this will give the tribes cause to sue them and get the land back. So as I mentioned, that this is an ongoing occupation, right? And their issue is, as they mentioned, you know, they have very specific issues about, you know, maintaining their lifestyle, maintaining their freedoms, and the sort of Christian, particularly Christian-based ideology, and having access to fossil fuels so that they can use the land the way they want to use it. But nobody in the reporting questions who they are and how they got there, and why they have these rights. These rights are based in colonial occupation and taking. And I think that's been really missing from the reporting on this. And so why are cities like Portland more willing to embrace different ideas? Because, you know, we're not tied to the land in the same way, the colonial taking in the same way. And, of course, we are more diverse, right? And so we have more ideas coming to the table about what possibilities can we pursue, you know, regarding climate change, regarding all these things that they don't want to be a part of. And their whole thing of moving the border negates tribal input. Nowhere in that reporting is it discussed that the tribal nations, the nine tribes of Oregon, have any say in this, right? It's not even mentioned. Just talking about the state legislatures, the governors, Congress, the president, votes by the state citizens, you know, nothing about the tribes and their role when this is their land, right? And I find that very striking. Once again, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host. This is American Standoff, and we're a live call-in. Thank you, Arthur. And the number here is 503-231-8187, and we're discussing Greater Idaho and what it means. And I'd also like to, you're discussing the issue of Indian people having a different view of these rural claims of land. I actually want to take this even further back to the handover of Oregon Territory from the Hudson Bay Company to the United States government. And what a huge impact this had. I think that we often don't, we never think about it. We never think about what that meant, right, in actuality. And I was actually, I really just stumbled upon this when I was asked to write a land back essay by a local Oregon Native Arts nonprofit. And I was reviewing the history of the taking of the land here in Oregon Territory. Full disclosure, I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation. My father is Dakota, so my tribes did not live here in Oregon. And so I was not as familiar with exactly the details of how the land was taken here. I did grow up in Washington State and took, you know, regular high school Washington State history, but it was still kind of fuzzy, you know, beyond the Whitman Massacre and things like that. I needed to revisit this history and understand it much more fully to be able to write about it in any meaningful way. And so I really looked at how that happened. How was the land taken? You know, before I wrote this essay, I had written about Malheur and Harney County and how the land was taken there, which is very interesting. And of course, you know, the Bannock Wars and how the Paiute people were dispossessed. The Paiute and Bannock people were dispossessed in that place. And so, I just felt I needed to understand particularly how it happened here in the Portland area in a much more authentic way. So reviewing the history of the taking of the land here in Oregon Territory, which did include actually parts of what they want to be Greater Idaho, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington State, I came across a very interesting YouTube channel called Kumtux, K-U-M-T-U-K-S. And some of the videos are about the Chinook Wawa language, the trade jargon that was spoken here and that really evolved here to allow trade to happen between different tribes and European and American and Canadian traders, which is a really fascinating thing in itself that a trade jargon developed. There was, it's such a really neat sort of thing that we can be proud of here, that there was the sort of coming together that was creating and beginning to form, a new sort of identity, right? And actually reviewing this material, I don't mean to jump ahead of presenting these ideas, but I really began to feel, you know, I often talk about, you know, how the U.S. is still a colony, right? And that Americans are colonists, right? And what does that mean? And how can we make that ethical and change the relationship? And so it does set up this sort of dichotomy of being an original citizen of an original nation and the occupiers, right? But is there a third way? That's what I wonder. Is there a third way? Is there a way? I mean, we really do have to find a third way to make this just, to make this equitable, to make it different in the past. To stop the suffering of Native people and Native youth and other people of color in this country, to really undo the quandary that white supremacy has placed us all in today in 2022. And I began to feel, reviewing this history of the Hudson Bay Company, that my understanding of the fur trade was really not good. But we often overlook the fur trade. We see it, at least I saw it, as sort of a precursor, a capitalistic precursor entering our communities and basically then bringing on the next thing, which is total occupation of our homelands and removal of our own people and genocide. And so I had never really looked at it that carefully. And also, full disclosure, I do have my father's family do have fur trader ancestry. My great-great-grandfather was a Bordeaux from the Rosebud Sioux Reservation. His grandfather was a chief of a Sichangi Lakota band, and his mother married a French trader from Canada, whose name was Bordeaux, and that family became. I think right now the chairman of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe is a Bordeaux, a distant cousin of mine, and so I do have an actual relationship to that history in the Dakotas, not here in the Pacific Northwest, obviously. But looking at it, I really began to feel like was this actually a missed opportunity, right? And reviewing, so this YouTube channel called Cumtux is run by a former Vancouver, British Columbia mayor named Sam Sullivan, right? And he is a quadriplegic, but he is incredibly compelling, incredibly well. I mean, the research is. I really suggest checking out his YouTube channel, Cumtux, Cumtux. And in one video called Early British Columbia and the Hudson's Bay Company, An Aboriginal Perspective, he reviews a letter written by several First Nation chiefs to Prime Minister Laurier after the Americans took over Oregon Territory and the Hudson Bay Company factors had been removed to British Columbia. And so I'm going to actually read. It's a very short letter. I'm going to read from it, and then I'll explain why I see this as an alternative, different, maybe even. It's not ethnic colonialism in that the beavers were hunted out and all that. That was not great, but as far as the power sharing between the Native nations, the Native nations here, and this capitalistic enterprise that has entered their area, it is really different than what we understood. What would happen after the Oregon Trail and the Americans came in. Okay, so here's the letter. 100 years ago, they came among us and erected a trading post. After the other whites came to this country in 1858, we differentiated them. Their manners were so different. We applied the term real whites to them. The real whites were good people. We could depend on their word. We trusted and respected them. They did not interfere nor attempt to break up our tribal organizations, nor force their conception of things on. They never tried to steal our country nor take our food and life from us. They acknowledged our ownership of the country and treated our chiefs as men. We treated them kindly and hospitably and helped them all we could. Some of our chiefs said, "We will help each other be great and good." And so once again, I want to invite you all to call in and be part of this discussion. I know I'm introducing a lot of disparate and possibly new material to folks. But the number here in the studio is 503-231-8187. And I really ask you to invite you to join the conversation here on American Standoff about Greater Idaho. And now we're discussing the history of the taking of the land and what that means and why rural Oregonians and I guess rural Northern Californians and Washingtonians feel so entitled to have this total say over the political enterprise here and want to be part of Idaho. What former Vancouver, BC Mayor Sam Sullivan says in his explanation is that the Hudson Bay Company actually refused to allow non-natives to settle, but settlers pressured the United Kingdom Parliament to abolish the company government and remove Governor James Douglas from power. So Governor James Douglas was very interesting, and he actually ran. He was the factor here at Vancouver, here in Washington, what is now Washington State, and he was a man of Creole background. He had Black ancestry from the Caribbean, and his wife was a Métis woman. She was part Indian from Canada, Cree, First Nations, and this was. It's just interesting to think that the origins of Oregon, starting with this sort of meeting between these groups with through the fur trade, was so multicultural. And when you look at the early census records, and I have in my work, you will see that there's a whole section in the early census records for this for Washington, Oregon, that is for Hawaiians. They have a different term for them, but there's like a couple of stories are so different than what we think of today. The world the world of Oregon was so different then. And now, of course, now Portland and Oregon is like one of the whitest places in the country. I think Portland is the whitest city west of the Mississippi or something. And but back then, that was not the case. The Oregon territory during the fur trade era was incredibly multicultural. And this was reflected even in the leadership. Later, Governor James Douglas removed to Vancouver, BC, and he and his wife were made, he was made a lord, he was made Sir Douglas, and his wife, a native, a Métis woman, was made Lady Douglas. And so it's just a really different conception when we think of race and what this place was like back then. The chiefs wrote of the new democracy. These First Nation chiefs had written to the Prime Minister, and I'm guessing this was around 1910, after they're being dispossessed of their lands. And it's very interesting, they note that within 11 years of the Americans taking over Oregon territory, all the tribes had been driven off into reservations and had been completely dispossessed. And the First Nations chiefs in this letter, they speak to that issue, like that they were so that the goal of the American enterprise was actually different than that of the trades in which both parties were equals and were beneficiaries of the fur trade. So different. And in fact, former Vancouver, BC Mayor Sam Sullivan notes that. So they actually, the Hudson Bay Company did not allow missionaries to come into their territory. Originally, this whole area was operated by the Northwestern Company, and then it later got bought out by the Hudson Bay Company. But both of these companies would not allow missionaries to come. And you should actually read the early letters of a minister who did come to Fort Vancouver, and just how upset he was at just all these mixed race people and just he could not handle the situation. In fact, he tried to insult the Métis women who were sort of at the top of the social heap at Fort Vancouver, and tried to diminish them. And so it's an interesting clash. And but what was happening here was actually something quite special, and I don't think that we think about it enough. And certainly Chinook Wawa, which I know that some Portland State University Native students started their own Chinook Wawa class to teach it, Chinook Wawa jargon. And so there is a lot of interest. Most of these Portland State students are not native from here. I know the student who's running it, I think he's Ho-Chunk from Wisconsin. And so this is something that is really unique. There was actually, with the Hudson Bay Company and Northwestern Company, a lot of Indian people came from, who were working for the company, who were Iroquois from Canada and New York State. And so I was speaking to, I was interviewing a local Grand Ronde tribal historian. He teaches at Oregon State, David Jean Lewis. And he was telling me how members of his tribe do have Iroquois ancestry documented because of these Hudson Bay Company workers that came here to work and married into the local tribes. And so the level of relationship and interconnectivity that the Hudson Bay Company brought is quite extraordinary. And I do think that we need to reevaluate and reassess that time period and maybe look for clues like how can, and definitely because the equality is based in land, right? The tribes were allowed to continue their to live on their lands unmolested, uninterrupted. Once you bring the Oregon Trail into the history, which in so many ways Oregon really sees that as the beginning of its own history, right? The state and Washington State as well, and Idaho, all these states that were beneficiaries of that movement of people white pioneers into this area. But the taking of the land, land back, I would say, is more than just a hashtag. It's actually a way of political reorganization, and the focus of the greater Idaho folks on the land, on taking the land, is everything you need to know about this issue, right? And they really feel quite entitled. And but their claim is based on colonization, on genocide, the removal of the people of whose homeland this is, and then their right to exploit and use the land as they see fit. And they're always using mechanisms to try to do this. As you heard in the reporting earlier about Greater Oregon, there's very little, it's unlikely that this will actually happen because it has so many levels where it needs to be approved. But the fact that it's what they're focused on is quite disturbing. And that this commotion they're creating, whether it's opening the doors at Salem to armed, folks or rushing into hospitals unmasked or going to speak at white supremacist, white anti-Semitic conferences run by Nick Fuentes, all of these things are very disturbing. So we have just a 5 minutes left, but I would like to urge you to call in. I would love to hear your take on this. The number here is 503-231-8187, and this is American Standoff, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host, and we're discussing Greater Idaho. Why is it gaining traction? Even though, like as I mentioned, it has very little chance of actually happening. We have counties in Oregon, several counties who voted by a very small majority, I should say, to begin the process of considering and petitioning the state legislature to leave the state of Oregon and join Idaho. And so I'd love to hear what folks think of that. And I think that, you know, we talk about being Oregonians. You know, they don't even know, I tried to research this, they don't even know where the term Oregon comes from, Oregon Territory. They think that it may have to do with having someone found oregano, the herb, having found it here. That's a guess. They don't even know where Oregon comes from. But what could it be? You know, and looking at the past and understanding the past is really important. And I think this is why my lens as a Native woman, as a woman whose nation is tied to the land, our claims are tied to the land itself. And the occupation, and we are, our existence, our political existence as Native nations, is an act of resistance of the occupation and the taking of our homeland. And so these rural white, and these folks who are voting to leave Oregon, I have, is a breakdown of their ethnic racial background. But I'm pretty much sure that it's almost entirely white people, right? I think any informed Native person would be like, wait a minute, what about my tribe? What what's going on here? You know, and because Idaho is very, is not friendly to tribes, right? So we haven't called. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi, you're on American Stand-Up.
Great. I just wanted to bring this back to local politics again, because there's a lot of white supremacists running for office, and one is a Dan Tooze that's running in for District 40 for state rep, and he's having an event that looks over the Willamette Falls, which is just disgusting to me. But one of the GOP guys running for governor, Mark, speak and at his fundraiser. So is Mark Scholl, who is a county commissioner for Clackamas County that we're trying to recall, and another woman, Heinemann Allen, who is also, she's running against one of the people in Clackamas, on the Clackamas County Commission. Be careful who you vote for, and know that there's a lot of the militia running for office with the support of the Republican Party in the state. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Oh, could you repeat those races again?
Mark, he's running for governor, and he's going to speak at this fundraiser for Dan Tooze, who is running for state rep District 40. And Dan is a known militia member. Also, Mark Scholl, who is a county commissioner for Clackamas County, who right now is we're trying to recall him because he's a racist and a Islamophobe. And Dana Heineman Allen is speaking at this event, and she is running against Sonia Fisher, who is on the county commission. She's one of the good guys on the county commission. Mm. Anyway, so there's other people speaking. I don't know, can't speak to them, what they are. But anyway, this is a right-wing speaking event, and we need to be really aware of who these people are and what they stand for. So anyway.
I totally agree. I would like to, I will try to find, maybe if you could, I don't know if you could, I'll try to find a link to listing all these candidates, and maybe I'll do a show looking at them in detail, because I agree. This is part of their strategy, is to just take. They're really running everywhere. All of these folks, these really right wing extremist folks, even QAnon supporters have made it to Congress. You know, but they're running at every level.